Domestic extremist wide-ranging ideologies pose unique challenges to New Jersey and the surrounding region as they employ a variety of robust methods to conduct attacks, have varying motivations, and are often willing to engage in violence.
This is Director Jared Maples of the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. Welcome back to Intelligence Unclassified, a podcast about counterterrorism, cybersecurity, and emergency preparedness. Join us as we talk to local and national experts in these fields to discuss New Jersey's diverse threat landscape and offer you a unique perspective on current trends and issues facing our great state. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed, iTunes, or Google Play. You can also follow NJOHSP on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at NJOHSP. All links can be found in the show notes and on our website, www.njohsp.gov.
Hello, everybody. On today's episode of Intelligence Unclassified, I am joined by New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness Domestic Terrorism Analyst, Matt.
Hello, everyone.
And Christine.
Hello, everyone.
So before we begin, Matt, can you quickly describe what domestic terrorism is?
Yeah, Dylan. So in the back of our recently released threat assessment, we actually have definitions of all of our different groups and a few other things that kind of go with our office. Domestic terrorism is defined in there, and it is violence committed by individuals or groups, including anti-government, race-based, religious, and single-issue extremist ideologies associated primarily with U.S.-based movements.
Okay, Matt, so you defined what domestic terrorism was. What overall domestic extremist trends did we see last year, and what will we see going into this year?
So overall, we saw that the wide-ranging ideologies pose unique challenges to New Jersey and the surrounding region. We saw that a lot of these domestic extremists use a variety of methods to conduct attacks. They had varying motivations and are often willing to engage in violence. In our threat assessment, we highlight the attacks that occurred back in 2018, and a review of them shows that we actually had a decrease from 23 in 2017 to 16 in 2018. And then in there, we actually kind of break down all of the different attacks and numbers. So we had 16 domestic extremist attacks in 2018, and we had 16 deaths as a result of these attacks. And we have them split up where 9 attacks were contributed by race-based extremists, 5 to anti-government extremists, and then 2 for single-issue extremists. We also have 9 opportunistic and 7 planned, which means that the 9 of those opportunistic incidents, they occurred when someone just kind of spur of the moment conducted with the attack or the plot or whatever really was that was going on there.
When you say opportunistic, do you mean that it wasn't really much of a plot? It wasn't really planned?
So yeah, for the opportunistic events, those were kind of spur of the moment where they just kind of took advantage of whatever the situation was to go and conduct their attack.
So Matt, you talked about the domestic extremist attacks. So something new this year that I see in the threat assessment that we put together is that domestic extremist attacks are now laid out in a timeline. What is the purpose of this timeline and why did you choose to highlight those attacks specifically?
Yeah, so in the past, we've had different timelines either to highlight the New Jersey-based incidents that we had, or we had specific ideology timelines to show their attack. However, we wanted to show that domestic extremists do have wide-ranging motivations and ideologies, and they do conduct attacks in the United States. So the purpose of this timeline is to show just quickly what the attack was, what type of ideology conducted it, and when it happened. So you can really see how we have the 2-page spread of all the attacks that occurred from domestic extremists.
So now looking at this timeline, let's discuss some of the trends from each group that we see, the groups that you guys consider domestic extremist groups. So starting with anarchists, what type of trends will anarchists employ going into 2019? What can we expect?
So in 2019, we'll see that anarchist extremists will mobilize in response to issues they believe are unjust, carry out criminal and violent acts during otherwise First Amendment protected events and protests, and target perceived enemies. So throughout 2018, anarchist extremists were actively engaged in criminal activities in the tri-state region, which resulted in at least 20 arrests.
So the anarchist extremists that were active in our region, we hear the term Antifa a lot, and I know that there are local Antifa groups within our region. What exactly is Antifa?
So in the threat assessment, we actually give a quick overall definition of Antifa and kind of break it down just to make it a little bit easier. So Antifa is a movement that focuses on issues involving racism, sexism, and anti-Semitism, as well as other perceived injustices. Now, the majority of Antifa members do not promote or endorse violence. However, the movement does consist of anarchist extremists, which we talked about in the product, and other individuals who seek to carry out acts of violence in order to forward their prospective agendas. And that's where you get the anarchist extremist version. They're a part of the overall movement there.
So thanks, Matt, for talking about the anarchist extremists and telling us what Antifa is. So I see the next group that's covered in the domestic extremist section of the threat assessment are militia extremists. Christine, what trends will militias employ in the upcoming year?
So militia extremists across the United States will oppose unlawful immigration, attempt to intimidate Muslims, and encourage violence at protests, a departure from their previous encounters with the federal government. So claiming that the deep state is preparing for illegitimate power, one national militia group announced it was going to organize training sessions across the country aimed at helping militia members prepare for lethal force at various events.
So, Christine, thanks for talking about what militias will do in 2019. And I see that in the threat assessment this year, you guys highlight three individuals that were part of a militia extremist group. Can you quickly explain who they are and what they did? Like, what exactly prompted them to be included in this year's threat assessment specifically?
Okay, so the three individuals are Michael Howery, Michael McWhorter, and Joe Morris. In March, federal authorities charged these three White Rabbit militia members for bombing a Minnesota mosque in August of 2017. One of the members told an FBI agent that he wanted to scare Muslims out of the country. Upon further investigation, federal authorities found an email account that was allegedly associated with these members, which they used to receive missions from higher-ups. These same individuals had also attempted to bomb an Illinois abortion clinic back in November of 2017.
So I see that militia extremists are considered a moderate threat, and I see that you also have sovereign citizens as a moderate threat. What is a sovereign citizen?
According to our definition, a sovereign citizen extremist throughout the United States view federal, state, and local governments as illegitimate, justifying their violence and other criminal activity.
What types of things do we expect to see from sovereign citizens coming into 2019?
Law enforcement remains the primary target for sovereign citizen extremists nationwide, as they threaten to retaliate against those who challenge their ideology, stockpile weapons, and continue to attack police. Just in 2018 alone, sovereign citizen extremists conducted four attacks throughout the country, three of which of those targeted law enforcement, using small arms and explosives as methods. However, over the past 2 years in New Jersey, there have been at least five cases of sovereign citizen extremists verbally threatening police. Sovereign citizen extremists in New Jersey have mostly engaged in nonviolent activity, such as self-identifying in court paperwork and traffic stops, and filing liens against public officials.
You mentioned that they file liens against public officials, and I see in here that you guys briefly discuss a new law that the state has enacted that allows law enforcement to charge these sovereign citizen extremists. Can you briefly discuss the law that New Jersey created?
Yes. So in May 2016, legislation in New Jersey enhanced penalties associated with the filing of fraudulent liens to retaliate against public officials. Sovereign citizens have since adopted new methods to circumvent the law. But when we look at sovereign citizen extremists, on May 23rd, our office actually arrested and charged Courtney Alexander of Irvington on two counts of second-degree fraudulent filings and one count of third-degree retaliation against a witness for a prior incident. Back in 2015, Alexander placed fraudulent liens against two police officers who'd issued him a traffic citation, as well as a local prosecutor and a municipal judge assigned to the case. Alexander is considered the first New Jersey resident charged under this new law for filing fraudulent liens.
Thanks, Christine, for explaining to everybody what a sovereign citizen extremist is. So the last moderate domestic threat I see on here is white supremacist extremists. And I know that white supremacist extremism has been kind of a trending topic as of late, dominating a lot of the news and different organizations talking about it. What trends do we expect from a white supremacist extremist going into 2019?
One of the things we really tend to saw over the last year and we see going into the new year is that you have this new generation of white supremacists who are altering their public image in order to appear less extreme, they're leveraging perceived fears, and they're rebranding in order to conceal their hate-driven ideology. Since the Unite the Right rally in late 2017, you saw that these white supremacists have shifted from going to an overall national movement to disparate groups that tend to concentrate on the alleged political and social interests of the white race.
So what is actually the reasoning behind the rebranding? Like, are they attempting to appear less violent? Are they trying to appeal as more mainstream? Because I know we've discussed a lot that the white supremacist extremists are kind of leaning away from the typical neo-Nazi look with the swastika tattoos, and they're kind of going to more a clean-cut look. Is there like a real reason, or what do you assess as this purpose?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously with every type of group, you need to build recruitment, you need to push your movement forward, and you need people to sympathize and support what you say. So they're going away from the Nazi flag waving, swastika tattoos to the more clean cut political side where they can really kind of push this ideology to a wider spectrum of people. And in turn, they'll be able to build new recruits from that. They'll be able to push their agendas a little bit easier than they could in the past because people are more willing to listen to somebody who's clean cut and claiming that they're trying to help certain people compared to somebody who's going around saying that either Jews or other races are inferior to them or they're waving Nazi flags.
in the threat assessment, you mentioned the New Jersey European Heritage Association. So what is that group exactly? I mean, I see you guys have an example of one of their flyers, their recruitment flyers. Is that a group that's pretty present in our state, or are they active? What exactly are they up to? And just give a little brief description on that group.
Yeah, so the New Jersey European Heritage Association, they were formed in early 2018, and since then, they've really pretty much just been trying to build recruitment and their message across New Jersey, mainly through flyering or banner drops. On the surface, this group claims that they are more of a grassroots organization, and they're trying to bring their ideology into the public mainstream in order to enable supporters to take swift and immediate action against the people who are destroying the white race and civilization. Essentially, they're doing this by attempting to show that they're out there cleaning the community, they're out there to help the white race. But really, when you know what you're looking for and you start reading some of their flyers, some of the things that they're saying, the propaganda, you see that it really kind of stems off a lot of anti-Semitism, racism, and some well-known white supremacist slogans and phrases are also within their products as well.
So you said that this group is conducting flyering throughout the state. And I also see in the threat assessment that you include this heat map. Can you give an overview of the heat map and explain how these groups are spreading their ideology throughout the state?
Yeah, so the heat map shows 46 reported incidents of white supremacist propaganda distribution in 2018. So we have it highlighted where you really had the mass concentration. You can see up in like a little bit north of New Jersey there where there's a big center. The reason why there was so much there is because there's been a huge push to put these flyers on college campuses to try to recruit that younger educated generation. And you do have a lot of different colleges and universities centered in that area where a lot of this kind of went from there. And we saw that last year, about 65% of the propaganda that was placed on there had references to white genocide. So white genocide is the belief that the white race will become extinct due to forced assimilation, non-European immigration, and interracial marriage. Now, white supremacists have really kind of started using this to support the purpose of their existence and to spread fear that their race will lose its superiority if supporters do not join them.
This concept of white genocide, is that something that's prevalent in most white supremacist extremist organizations or just the New Jersey-based ones?
You'll see it all nationwide. It really isn't to one specific group or individual. It just kind of depends on what type of reasoning they're pushing out to the public to kind of claim the reason for them to be there.
I see that, you know, we have that huge, it looks like that huge red area in the central and northern part of New Jersey where you said it's kind of concentrated around college campuses. Like, what do you guys actually consider putting on the map? Are we talking one poster where somebody might have hung up one poster? Are we talking mass distribution of hundreds of flyers? What constitutes a flyering campaign?
It really depends on the instance. So like I said, these are 46 reported instances of white supremacist propaganda distribution. That's not to say there's only 46 flyers. Each instance could have one flyer, could have five, and then in some cases we've had up to 30 of them being distributed in the different areas that are around there.
So talking about these white supremacist extremists and their propaganda campaigns, I know in the last episode of the podcast we talked about ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and then the episode previous to that we talked about homegrown violent extremists. And I here at the office, I cover ISIS and homegrown violent extremists, so we talk a lot about foreign terrorist propaganda and how they will use the internet kind of similar to these domestic extremists with their propaganda campaigns. I mean, we see a lot of that coming from foreign terrorist groups. So are these domestic groups, are they kind of adopting similar tactics? Are we seeing them chatting online? I mean, we always talk about how ISIS and homegrown violent extremists will talk on apps such as Telegram, and they'll try to recruit on social media. Are these domestic groups specifically white supremacists, or we can even talk about the other groups, the militia extremists? Just how are these folks recruiting and getting that propaganda out? Like, and is it comparable to homegrown violent extremists and ISIS?
In our society now, we are seeing a lot of this white supremacist propaganda online, where a lot of these people are going on there to spread this hate-driven ideology. But post-Charlottesville rally, a lot has changed since then, and a lot is not in the mainstream. A lot of things on Twitter and Facebook changed their rules and regulations to kind of fend off some of this rhetoric that has been posted online, which is kind of forcing these people to go on other methods to say their message, like the dark web.
So Matt, when you talked about the different online communities that these folks are using, do you have an example of an extremist that conducted some sort of an attack or plotted an attack using social media, or may have been radicalized similar to ISIS and homegrown violent extremists?
Yeah, so going back to the white supremacist extremists, one of the most infamous individuals that used social media and gab prior to conducting the attack was Robert Bowers, who was the Tree of Life Pittsburgh synagogue shooter. Prior to his shooting, he actually posted on Gab for months at a time different anti-Semitic or racist posts, advocated for different white supremacy. And then actually 2 hours before the attack happened, he posted on Gab that a certain Jewish religious organization likes to bring in invaders that kill our people. And by our people, he meant white people. And that he can't stand by and watch white people get killed. And he said, screw your optics, I'm going in. He posted that on the website and then 2 hours later went and conducted the attack. So there are people out there who are using and advocating for either violence or some type of violent ideology on social media. Gab is one of many platforms that are used. It's not only the sole one.
So, Matt, I know you've been looking at white supremacist extremists and all race-based extremism for the latter part of 3 years, and Christine is one of our new analysts who's now focusing on race-based extremism. As a person who's been doing this and is a subject matter expert on this ideology, what types of trends have you seen over the years that you've been conducting this research, and things that you could recommend to Christine as she moves forward in adopting this portfolio with you?
Over the last few years, one of the biggest changes that we saw was the switch of propaganda distribution. So you go back to 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago, a lot of it really kind of came from the KKK, and most of their propaganda was either in support of that group or it was anti-Semitic or racist, very overtly with that message.
Is the KKK still active as well in our state?
Yeah, so they are still active within the state, still distributing propaganda, kind of like these newer groups are as well. The KKK really still has the same exact tactics that they use to distribute the propaganda, as well as the same type of message that they're pushing across.
You were talking about how the messaging has changed. So have you witnessed this actual change? Like, have you been working that issue through the evolution of the messaging campaigns that you've been discussing and that you talk about in the threat assessment?
Yeah, so like I said, you go back a few years, it was mainly just KKK. Now, as time moved forward, you have all these different groups kind of popping up, and they're all changing their message, too. They're not going just straight, overtly anti-Semitic, overtly racist. It's now when you get that white genocide thing that I talked in before. They're now going back to the, we need to protect the white race, not we need to stop all these other races.
Christine, now that you're adopting this portfolio and covering domestic extremism and specifically these race-based extremists, what type of things have you seen? And what, as a new analyst here at the office, what are some of the things that you have seen through your short time here?
So when we're looking at Patriot Front, which was an offshoot of Vanguard America, they rebranded their image back in August of 2017, and they went from this evolution of a neo-Nazi organization to one that's reflecting more of a skewed version of American white nationalism in order to appeal to this broad range of supporters. So as Matt was saying, everything is evolving and changing with this group. And just even throughout the past year, members of the group had blended iconic American symbols with white supremacist imagery to alter the appeal of their website, their social media accounts, and different written propaganda as well.
Are they active in our state as well?
Yes. Within the last year, they have placed flyers on different institutions.
So we've talked about Patriot Front and other white supremacist organizations. Will these groups sort of conflict with other ideologies if they are present at the same time? I mean, we talked earlier and we touched briefly on anarchist extremists and also with Antifa and how they kind of target their perceived injustices. And one of the injustices was racism. So do we expect to see if these folks are together? Do these conflicting ideologies have issues?
Yeah, so Dylan, like we said, anarchists, extremists will kind of mobilize to issues they see as unjust. And one of the most recent examples was actually in New Jersey. Back in January, the New Jersey European Heritage Association claimed that they were going to have a rally in Princeton, New Jersey. So this quickly got picked up by multiple different anarchist extremist groups who all claimed that they were going to show up and counter-protest the rally. Now, there was no overt claims of violence that was going to occur. However, we have seen in the past at different rallies throughout the United States that when you have multiple extremist ideologies show up together, a lot of times violence ensues.
So how we talked about anarchist extremists and how they will mobilize against perceived injustices, I mean, it's almost inherent in their ideology to essentially mobilize against groups like New Jersey European Heritage Association.
They perceived New Jersey European Heritage Association as a white supremacist extremist group that was going to conduct some type of real-world operation, and you had different extremists from the tri-state region all claim that they were going to show up had the rally actually happened.
Great. Well, thank you, Matt and Christine, for joining us on Intelligence Unclassified today to talk about the domestic extremism that is focused on in the 2019 Terrorism Threat Assessment. If you're interested in learning more about these groups, you can go ahead to our website at www.njohsp.gov and go ahead and read the Terrorism Threat Assessment. It is out. It came out in late January. So again, thank you for joining us, and Intelligence Unclassified signing out.
All links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njohsp.gov. If you have any ideas or topics for future episodes, please contact us on Twitter at NJOHSP or email us at intelunclass@njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.